Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's April 29th. I haven't had a call from the ABC Forecast Center, so let me tell you that right now we've got 42 degrees here in Old Town Park City, and the forecast today, calling for mostly sunny skies, looking for a high, a warm one, 74 is the expected high, winds out of the south, 5 to 10 miles per hour, an overnight low of 48 degrees, a high tomorrow of 73 with a 20% chance of an afternoon and evening thunderstorm as the temperature heats up. But by Friday, we're back into the mid-60s, again with partly sunny skies. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt. Later on, Park City Manager Matt Dias with a preview of the agenda for Thursday's City Council meeting. And finally, Lori and Mike Hampton talking about the new Facebook page, Support a Park City High School Senior. Stay tuned. And stay tuned, coming up on The Mountain Life, right after the local news hour. Today's guests include Summit County resident Chris Spieler, the owner of CrossFit Park City, a legend and icon in the CrossFit world. Spieler recently meeting a new challenge, the confines and quarantine of having COVID-19. Then, in the last couple of months, most of us have found more time for involved conversation. Daniel Spielman is a corporate facilitator, keynote speaker, and podcaster. He'll talk about how to design conversations that matter. His new book is called Good Talk. It's a step-by-step framework to affect change in your personal and professional conversations. Taking a look now at some local news, former Park City Manager Diane Foster has been named as the new Assistant City Manager for Aspen. The announcement was made at last night's Aspen City Council meeting. Foster was let go by the Park City Council last October, with the council saying that they were moving in a new direction. In a press release from Aspen, it says that Foster was chosen from 71 applicants, and she comes to Aspen with more than a decade of municipal leadership experience and expertise. In her position with Aspen, Foster will assist in the implementation of COVID-19 recovery strategies, as well as overseeing the city's largest department, Parks and Recreation. In addition, she'll be responsible for guiding Aspen downtown's vitality and parking, transportation, and kids' first departments while supervising the staff of the Aspen-Pitkin County Housing Authority. This position has been open for the last 16 months. One of Foster's immediate tasks will be to oversee the transition of the departments that the outgoing Parks and Recreation Director currently oversees. In a prepared statement, Aspen City Manager Sarah Ott said that the hiring of Foster is positive news for the city of Aspen as an organization and a community. Foster said Ott has the experience to help implement policies to move forward. Foster's first day is May 11th. News time, 8:09. The Park City School District's bond architects, MHTN, will have cost estimates to the Board of Education in the next month or two. Moving ninth grade back to Park City High School remains a top priority for the school district. A multitude of considerations will drive a final school board decision regarding the final design, project phasing, and how much the community is willing to spend. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more.
The facility changes that are being considered are part of a long-term phasing project, and the architects who are working on the cost details have narrowed options to three overarching designs. Those drawings can be found on the pcschools.us website. Moving 8th grade to Ecker Hill to create a 6th through 8th grade school is part of the plan. Adding 4 pre-K classes for each elementary school is also in the proposal. MHTN architect and project manager Scott Lader says the changes will be phased in over 10 to 15 years. He says they're considering the current financial market as they make their recommendations to the Board of Education. A preferred option for the high school expansion would require the demolition of McPolin Elementary School.
We are exploring a number of different options for McPolin in particular, whether that's an addition or a future relocation of that building. Yes, there could be an expansion to that eastern edge, but it could be more tucked closer to the building to allow for McPolin to remain. So we're still in the early process of developing those schemes for the high school. One recent development that we're working through right now is how we can begin to absorb the Learning Center into the high school program.
Later says their design options also take the traffic congestion on Kearns Boulevard into consideration by adding more efficient circulation behind the high school campus. Later says they're working with administrators to identify underutilized space at the high school before recommending additional square footage for other programs like PC caps and CTE.
Providing the facilities that would accommodate those that awesome program, but then start to look at the other avenues that would even bring in programs that are currently bused out to Heber, and adding those facilities on site so that really you have a complete holistic high school education right on that Park City site.
The phasing may include using the Treasure Mountain Junior High facility to temporarily house students instead of bringing portables on site during construction. Later says they're waiting for the Board of Education to rank the list of master planning priorities. He says the board is exploring different funding mechanisms.
As we present information back to them, we're making sure that they have the full picture of possibilities, potentially even exploring outside funding sources that could look at a way of getting the ball moving on this first phase of work, but not necessarily locking you into a formal bond campaign.
The plans show the changes in educational trends. The learning studio is replacing the classroom, where collaboration can be accommodated and the space can be reconfigured as needed. A cafetorium is a multi-purpose room as a place to bring a neighborhood together.
After school, it could be a place for community events, and so it becomes kind of a multi-swing space within the neighborhood. We really see elementary schools as the heart of a community, and by allowing places to congregate and visit and socialize, it really becomes a neighborhood center.
Cost estimates for all the options will be available by the June board meeting. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW.
KPCW News Time, now 8:13.
Hello, this is Bob Marsh with The Colony at White Pine Canyon. I am thrilled to introduce Kurt Peterson and Bronson Calder, who have joined me on the Colony sales team. We are longtime supporters of KPCW and its voice in the community. Tour information and lot availability can be found at thecolonywpc.com or 649-3411.
8:14. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Joining me now on the phone with an update on development projects happening in Summit County, I have Community Development Director Pat Putt. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Leslie. I hope you can hear me okay.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, great. Hey, so as usual, any new developments through the door since we last spoke?
You know, it's interesting. Everyone would assume that things from the planning department side would slow down. They really haven't. We average about 5 new applications coming in the door weekly. I mean, for example, we just had our staff meeting yesterday morning. We got roughly a half dozen, one of them being a redo or a going back through the process because of an expiration. A project in the canyons called Vintage on the Strand, and that's a smaller multifamily resort project just up above the Forum area. I think it's about a dozen, 13 multifamily resort units. Previously approved, didn't get the final site plan recorded or the condo plat completed, so they're coming back through. That's new. Number of subdivision plat amendments, things like moving building pads around, adjusting lot lines, Board of Adjustment variance applications. We've got an accessory dwelling unit coming in. So they're still coming in, and we're still being approached by prospective property owner developers wanting to sit down and talk about projects, I mean, countywide. So from that end, we're still busy. From the building side, we remain pretty busy as well. We average about 30 inspections a day. The plans for the Canyons Master Village Association employee housing project came in. We had talked about that last month when we last spoke. That project's in for a plan review, so it looks like that is most certainly moving forward. So from our end, we're staying rather busy.
Yeah, so would that, if it's just coming in for a plan review, there's no way that it would get under construction this year, or maybe?
Oh, most certainly. I would anticipate by as soon as possibly June, they could be breaking ground on that.
Okay. Let's see. An update from last night's Planning Commission meeting. We're trying to work out an interview with the new chairman. So maybe you can just start with that. A new chair and vice chair were elected?
Yep. So we have a new chairman, Ryan Dickey, and we have a new vice chair, Thomas Cook. Ryan will be taking over for Melena Stevens, who was the chair for the past year. For the public out there, we rotate that responsibility on an annual basis. Melena did an excellent job. You know, she was chairing during the whole discussion on everything, I think, from Colby School through the Kimball Junction Neighborhood Master Plan. So she'll be passing that torch on to Ryan. He had his first opportunity to chair a meeting last night under somewhat unusual conditions. We were doing it via a Zoom platform, which this was our first test drive of doing a planning commission under those situations. Council's been doing it for a number of meetings now. This was the planning commission's first meeting. We did a work session on that to at least get our feet on the ground. It went fairly well, I thought. Not that there probably may have been some glitches out there from the public perspective. We're going to be reaching out to see how that worked and looking for feedback. You know, it lacked it was sometimes sort of like a, you know, Hollywood Squares. It didn't have the comic relief of a Paul Lynde or the crusty reflections of a Grandpa Jones, but it seemed to get the job done, at least from a work session perspective. We discussed the Dakota Pacific project out at the Tech Center, the redo of the Tech Center project. Spent just about 2.5 hours going through a review of their revised application.
Okay. I want to talk to Ryan Dickey about that. But last night you mentioned that you do intend to have a public hearing on this project in the later part of May. So are you ready to hold a hearing on Zoom, especially when it will be important for the public to be able to comment on a project this size?
Well, I think where we ended the discussion is the public hearing will be in June and not in May. The next meeting that we're going to have, we're going to hold public hearings, and we're going to start with some, if there is such a thing in the Snyderville Basin as a simple or straightforward public hearing, we're gonna shoot for those. And there are a couple plat amendments that we believe would be good test cases for that. The other thing that we believe would make June a better public hearing for Dakota Pacific is all along there has been a desire, both I believe on the applicant's part and certainly the hope of the Planning Commission, that there would be an opportunity for some public outreach by the applicant to the community. Given where we are with sort of the social distancing and the COVID-19 situation we have, that makes holding open houses difficult. But the applicant's going to be going back and explore some ways that they can do some information outreach to the community in advance of a public hearing to make sure that when we open that discussion up, that we have a community that's well-educated on the nature not only of the current development agreement, what exists today, but what those changes are going to be. And I think that month time frame is going to allow for that exploration of what some of those non-traditional options, meaning other than a meeting in an open house in a gathering space, would look like.
So the discussion mostly about getting data, Snyderville Planning Commission is asking for things like, I mean, we're talking about 1,100 residential units, 122,000 square foot hotel, 235,000 square feet of office space. What about the traffic impacts? Do we know what that's going to be?
We were prepared to have that discussion last night. The applicants had their transportation mobility consultant there. The evening got really long, and so I think that specific discussion will be the next topic that we'll take up. That could happen as a work session prior to the public hearing, or it could be its own standalone work session. We're going to have that conversation to figure out what works best for the Planning Commission. But yeah, you hit it on the head. Really what we did is took a big deep dive into the proposed revisions to their plan, both in the square footage numbers, the parking implications, the open space implications, those sort of things. And again, when you do it off a Zoom platform, it's a somewhat slower, possibly more tedious way of the question and answering. It took a fair amount of time. But the traffic implications of these density square footage reductions, we did not get to last night.
So looking at the plans, is this project walkable? And especially, does it do anything about the hazards of getting across Highway 224?
Yeah, you know, is it walkable? I think that's the conclusion that we're attempting to get to. Is it or isn't it? From the initial review of what we looked at last night, internally, yeah, we think that there are some areas that have some significant beneficial changes to it. You know, the sort of the pedestrian connection within the development proposal and how it connects to the broader neighborhood and open space and recreation areas around it and the services around it. So our initial reaction is a optimistic yes. How the project connects across 224 to the east side of the highway was an observation that a couple of the commissioners had made. This particular proposal comes back and focuses fundamentally on the property that the applicant owns, Dakota Pacific owned property. It isn't necessarily shutting the door to a look at, say, the county owned properties. The other thing that's going on here, too, is UDOT is underway with its corridor planning for the Interstate 80, 224 intersection and the corridor up the highway. So it's not precluded that we're not going to have, you know, a pedestrian crossing, whether that's a tunnel or a bridge. Where we are right now is somewhat agnostic of that. But the Planning Commission is very, very concerned that if we are going to introduce more residential units in that area, that they want to have a very viable and safe way of connecting people across to the east side. They recognize the fact that they've got the circulator, the shuttle, but I think the Planning Commission is probably looking for something much more beyond that.
So the applicant came in within the density that was already approved under the Park City Tech Park. Gone, though, are the Civic Building, that underground transit hub. So some of the community benefits, I mean, why now we're just talking about a mixed-use, another large development instead of a tech park. So I'm just kind of curious, what are the community benefits left with this?
Well, that's part of that ongoing discussion. I think it's important for the listening community to understand as well. Those proposed development ideas on, say, the library property, the Richens property, where the transit center are, the other property owned by Summit County, those decisions are ultimately made by the council. I would suggest that in moving forward in evaluating this plan, that does not preclude the subsequent discussion a little further down the road with the council in terms of what could happen either independently or jointly with the county on the county's property. And I think that's probably a fair way of moving forward, because at this point, it's probably not necessarily the purview for the Planning Commission to get too far out into some of the discussions that one might happen on the county property until the council's had a chance to see it. And so what they're going to be starting with is reviewing what changes are going to take place or possibly take place on the applicant's property. So where we are right now is there's been a reduction in some of the square footages and the different uses. I think we started out with the existing approval that was 1.295 million square feet. Their original proposal, which included some new development on the county land, was up to about 1.8 million. Now we're back down to just shy of the 1.295. The question really becomes, given the fact that it appears the square footage is the same, is the proposed plan that they have that integrates more residential uses, that has some commercial uses and resort uses, is that a better plan than the tech park plan that's out there right now? Is the current plan that has a number of office tech buildings and surface parking lots, is that better than the plan they're bringing in that attempts to create more open space, less surface parking areas, arguably better neighborhood connectivity? Is that a better plan or not? In addition to that, the other question becomes, is the 306 workforce housing units appropriate in this location, and can it be done in a way to not make the traffic circulation worse? Those are the questions that, you know, we'll be continuing to examine and move forward and build ultimately to a recommendation by the commission and an ultimate decision by the council.
Okay, we got a lot to get through, and I only have about 3 minutes. Any news on the Deseret Wellness Cannabis Pharmacy?
No, we have not received any further inquiries. We haven't received a building permit, no calls for sit-downs, all very, very quiet.
Okay. What about the status of Henry Sieg mixed-use development?
Really good question. Next Wednesday at the council meeting, council's going to have a public hearing on Mr. Sieg's proposal for the neighborhood mixed-use zone and its companion master plan development. Need to remind everybody that that's really sort of the first step in the process, is the creation of a new zone in order to consider a mixed-use project out in the Silver Summit area. It's gone through it had a favorable recommendation from the Planning Commission last year. It's gone through a couple of work sessions with the council. We'll go back next Wednesday for a public hearing on that. There is a possibility it's being scheduled for a possible action. It doesn't necessarily mean that council will take final action on it, but I would expect that there would be action taken on it here in the very near future. And action would probably be, you know, a decision to move forth as it is proposed right now or with some modifications. And so once that is decided, then we're going to probably be going back to the Planning Commission with a specific plan. That plan is continuing to be reworked. It's being reworked based on, I think, a more in-depth review of the traffic circulation and some of the existing street infrastructure in that area. So the plan that we have now is likely to be somewhat revised or changed from the one that was originally presented to the Planning Commission a number of months ago.
Okay. And I heard you had a planner leave.
Well, not yet. Sean Lewis is one of our planner threes. Sean's been with the county for a very, very long time. He took it upon himself, in addition to his regular day job, to go back and get a master's degree in public administration from BYU Salt Lake, and been looking for a while to find an opportunity to step up in his career. And he was extended an offer by South Salt Lake City to be the assistant planning director, accepted that job offer. We're really excited for him. He's been working for this for a very long time, and he's going to be missed.
I was actually thinking about it this morning. He really doesn't go away, because if you call to the county and you get the phone voice that greets you, that's Sean. And we've negotiated an agreement with him to keep his voice as the voice on our voicemail for Summit County. So he doesn't go completely away. But as of, I believe, May 8th, which is next Friday, will be his last day, and he'll assume his new responsibilities, I think, that following Monday. So
do you replace him?
We're going to be determined at this point. I know council has made some very tough decisions on an amended budget that includes freezes on positions. And so it's probably too soon to tell. But my initial answer is, for the time being, we will not be replacing Sean. We've gone through at a staff level and took a look at all of his projects and assignments. We've reassigned them to the existing planning crew. So in terms of the people who he's been working with out there and the projects that are in his queue, there won't be any change in service level there. But I don't believe that we're going to be replacing Sean here in the very near future. I think we need to see what happens moving forward this summer into this fall, and then Tom Fisher will help us make that decision.
Okay, Pat Putt, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks a lot, Leslie. Stay safe.
KPCW News Time, now 8:33. Well, the Park City Council meets electronically tomorrow, and the fun with a preview of the agenda. Park City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie.
So people can tune in by going online to parkcity.org, click on the meetings tab on the right side, and they'll find the instructions about how to do that. So quickly, before we get to the agenda, what's the latest with the post office? Work session is going to be scheduled either next month or June?
Previously, Councilmember Nan Worrell and several other members, had received complaints from the community about a longstanding policy to not have game boxes allowed in Old Town. We've had discussions with the post office for years, so in the next month or two here, we're inclined to bring back a work session to have that discussion. And staff is doing some work digging up some old staff reports from, almost a decade ago, but given the emergency, it's just taken us a little while to put that information together.
Okay. I mean, this is something the city's kind of not wanted to see, taking the post office off Main Street. I think it's something that the post office kind of says it's ready to get off Main Street, and which is why they agreed to build the gang boxes. Is that still the council's sense, is that we want to keep a Main Street post office?
Obviously, we'd have to ask that question. And my understanding is that's always been the desire. There's always been a sense of community and camaraderie and seeing your neighbor in terms of that post office being kind of this vestige of small town community. And so the discussion that we are likely to have won't be anything to the extent of whether or not we're going to have a post office on Main Street, at least to my knowledge. It's more about, do we want to loosen our regulations in Old Town in the historic district to allow for some gang boxes?
All right, let's see. At 4 o'clock, a work session to discuss the PCSLC Connect agreement and electric bus purchase. It sounds like the city's going to buy 14 new buses, four of them specifically for the Park City SLC Express service. Are we only using electric buses on this route now?
We are trying. I mean, obviously, we have very, very robust and rigorous net zero goals and sustainability aspirations as an organization. And so this is a very large new acquisition of rolling stock that aligns with the sustainability goals. So this would be, as you mentioned, almost 14 new buses in our fleet that would be entirely electric. We're taking advantage of an existing purchase by UTA, where they're going to be purchasing, almost over 30 buses. And so not only can we save money for the taxpayers by jumping on to that purchasing, but by and large, the vast majority of the funding is funded through federal grants, some money that we have through a Volkswagen settlement, a grant from Rocky Mountain Power. So for $15 million worth of rolling stock and electric buses and equipment, the local money or local match is around $1 million. So it's just a really advantageous to be able to take advantage of UTA's large bulk purchase and then the grant funding that's available to our jurisdiction.
Yeah, so the cost about $1.6 million. And part of that, the city has to buy a new electric bus charger. Didn't we just replace the one at the Kimball Transit Center when it was damaged? Now we need a new one?
Well, we have two. We actually have two already. The way the technology is moving, it's actually moving away from the overhead chargers. So we have equipment in our facility right now that has what's called a trickle charger, which is more or less just plugging into a wall. Now, that's a very crude way of describing that because these are very large systems and lots of wattage and all sorts of equipment. But in the future, there are all sorts of new bus manufacturers that are making this electric technology. So we're really excited. This is going to be a competitive procurement. As I mentioned, UTA is seeking, almost 30 vehicles. And so we should see several different providers come in with their different types of technology. And the technology is leaning more towards that trickle charger where you can plug in the bus inside a bus barn overnight. And you don't necessarily need that overhead charger.
Hmm. And then any changes to the interlocal agreement? It looked like Park City has to pay for the insurance on the buses, even though they are UTA drivers.
No, so I don't think there's anything substantive in the agreement that will change. This is obviously very advantageous for our community and the fact that we have some capital assets that we share in insurance and other things, but it's mainly operated by the Utah Transit Authority, and the buses are stored down there and maintained by the Transit Authority. And, you know, this is a relationship that goes back a decade, and we're very lucky to have it.
All right, another budget discussion and preview of the fiscal year 2021 budget. This is being called a provisional budget. What does that mean?
Well, the intent of using that word was to be really, really transparent to the public in that we will come back and have to readopt our budget this fiscal year. There is so much uncertainty and so much volatility in our revenue as a result of the economic impacts of COVID-19. That we didn't feel that we were even in a position to sort of hastily come in and start slashing services or start slashing budgets to not be able to meet community demands in the short term. So we're coming in with a provisional budget, and the intent is to be transparent to the community that we will return within 60 to 90 days and likely readopt the budget when we have more certainty about what the summer looks like, what the fall might look like, what next winter might look like. And we felt like it would be imprudent to sort of come in too early in the system and make drastic cuts before we really got a better sense of the economic recovery or stabilization that we're about to enter.
So we're expecting for the current budget year an almost $4 million shortfall, and then for fiscal year 2021, a projected shortfall of more than $8.5 million. Is the majority of this due to sales tax losses?
It is indeed. More or less, sales tax has become almost a third or even well over a third of our total revenue. And so to think that we have this type of economic shutdown for a third or one leg of the stool that Park City Municipal sits upon, that's a huge impact to us financially. And so we are obviously doing everything we can. We are in full recession mode. We have foregone any sort of non-essential purchases, non-essential hires, hiring freezes, and doing everything we can to constrain ourselves during these 60 to 90 days to continue to provide services that the community relies upon and needs, but then set ourselves up to come back in. We can forecast with more certainty and potentially have to have more difficult discussions. So I hasten to say that I don't like to be an alarmist, but my thought is this $8 million deficit at this point may be the minimum. I mean, we may be looking at numbers far larger than that, but what we don't want to do with limited information is make hasty decisions.
So for the proposed cuts, $2 million has been identified for non-personnel department expenses. The report says service levels will be impacted. So what are we going to miss, or will we even notice?
Well, my hope is that people will notice, but they will understand what the impacts are. So we are obviously working diligently, trying to come up with operational plans to slowly sort of reopen our facilities and safely reopen our facilities to the public. But that may mean that, by way of an example, the mark is open. It has limited capacity. Maybe one of the pools is closed temporarily while the other pool is open. We're going to accrue cost savings by not hiring seasonal staff. Obviously there's going to be delays in things like our summer camp offerings, and we're bringing back less transit operators and running less transit services. So we're going to be eking all sorts of efficiencies out of our system that we can, rediverting those savings back into the system. And I think to the public, they will know that there's a little bit of a less offering, but those core services remain. There won't be any impacts to public safety. There won't be any impacts to our ability to respond to an emergency at a household or a water main break in one of our streets. But in terms of the non-essential services, we are going to have to do things like open one pool and not the other, or have maybe different working hours, trying to make sure that we can at least preserve minimum levels of service.
One of the charts in the staff report shows a 7% drop in property taxes. Why would that happen? Is this saying that property is being devalued?
No, actually, it's the opposite. Not that it's being devalued. We went back and we analyzed the impacts of the 2008 recession. Obviously, the 2008 recession had grave impacts for our sales tax, but there were trickle-down impacts to property taxes, and property taxes that went unpaid, were delinquent, or were defaulted upon. And so we anticipate, if we have a prolonged recession, if the economic hardships continue, that individuals will have, or property owners, excuse me, will have a hard time paying their property taxes. And so there is always some amount that will go unpaid, will go deferred, and we may collect in a future year. So we are preparing for that now and projecting for that now.
All right. Let's see. Under new business, the council will consider extending the Main Street outdoor dining program for another summer. Usually the decks go up May 1st. Do we know what they will look like at this point?
Well, our hope is that they, provided they can be operated safely and consistent with the governor's new stabilization orders, that they will go up very quickly. We are making a recommendation to the council for their consideration to provide more latitude when it comes to the dining deck. I think right now we're recommending, relieving the restaurant or business owner of having to pay any parking fees for the use of that parking stall, for the business license for that dining deck. We're entertaining, relieving some of the provisions that they have to serve a lunch and a dinner 7 days a week. All of this under the guise of trying to make it easier for businesses to get back up and going safely and responsibly.
So does that allow new folks, new restaurants, to then apply for a deck?
Well, so we have a component of that within the staff report that we are seeking council direction upon. There is a cap. I believe the cap is 12 on Main Street. And one of the questions that council will consider tomorrow afternoon is whether they want to expand that cap or perhaps relieve that provision temporarily in the event that we have additional businesses interested. And obviously we're choosing to do that in the council meeting because we know a lot of people will be watching, a lot of business owners will be listening, and it'll be a great time for that discussion to happen.
So any discussion for closing Main Street this summer to vehicles, so which would allow more spreading out of people on the street?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. We've obviously, when we were coming out of our visioning process, our community visioning process prior to the impacts of COVID-19, that was an idea that was circulating around the community and picking up some pace, and we hadn't done a lot of work on it yet. I think it's always been sort of this political football that's been thrown around. I think there were some discussions with Historic Park City Alliance, the Main Street Association, about are there additional ways that we can activate Main Street? Are there additional ways that the city could allow business owners to utilize the right of way to create more economy, more business, more vibrancy, but doing so responsibly? So an example would be if we have a retail establishment or a restaurant that's now limited because of new social distancing measures, is there a way the city could help out? Is there a way the city could allow additional use of sidewalks or even a parking stall to expand their footprint to help them with the social distancing measures? So to date, no discussions have happened. I think if people were interested in that, or the Historic Park City Alliance is interested in that, I think they'd probably come to us with a plan or some ideas. And I'd say that we're open to being creative and supporting local businesses however we can.
And what's the plan to bring back paid parking, if at all?
Well, we don't know yet. I think initially we're still in this kind of temporary suspension phase of any kind of parking requirements. We have some very bare minimums on Main Street just to make sure that it doesn't become a long-term parking lot. The last thing we'd want is someone in town kind of leaving their car there for a week. But I think temporarily, at least, we're going to do everything we can to try to responsibly and safely bring people back to Main Street. We want locals to engage in the local economy. We want them to be safe. And we're going to try to make sure that our parking program aligns with that vision and those values.
Okay, and finally, just wanted to ask you about the emergency proclamation to, or the resolution, excuse me, authorizing the allocation of emergency funds to local nonprofits. There was talk about $150,000 being given out to a handful of nonprofits. Has that already been handed out, or this is the action that would do that?
This is the formal action that would do that. So City Council two weeks ago, provided the policy direction and the commitment to these organizations. And this is the act that memorializes that transfer. So after tomorrow's evening, assuming everything goes as planned, we will be able to deliver this money to these frontline organizations. And so once that commitment was made, you know, these organizations obviously changed their operations and started digging even deeper into frontline assistance, knowing that we have made this commitment.
Okay. Matt, anything else you want to mention?
No, I don't think so. I just want to, you know, give another shout out to all kind of the men and women on the front lines in the organization, from transit to public safety to parks and streets and folks working on our trails. We've got all sorts of employees that have been preparing diligently to open our facilities next week, you know, assuming that the governor comes out with a new health order. Like anything, though, we're going to need some of your patience and some of your compassion. You know, our services may not be operating at 100%. But we're going to do the best that we can to support the community through this.
All right, Matt Dias, Park City Manager. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, in less than a week, more than 100 Park City High School seniors have been adopted by members of our community. On the phone to tell us a little bit more about the campaign and how you can participate or help, I have the administrators of the effort, Lori and Mike Hampton. Good morning to both of you. Are you there?
Yes, we're here. Good
okay.
morning.
All right, Lori. So tell me, this is a Facebook and Instagram campaign? When did it start?
It is. We started probably now about a week ago, and we just wanted to do something special. We also run the Ask Park City Facebook group, and there was lots of talk going on about wanting to do something for the seniors, and so we just put our minds together and decided to start the group so we could have them get adopted and just feel special in this time.
So what does it mean to be adopted?
It means that they just like pledge to either send like a letter, a card, a gift card, a gift, just a snack, or just like anything that they want to do just to know that we're rooting for them.
Yeah. And how many seniors today have been adopted?
I think we're a little bit over 160 at this point.
Wow. And how many seniors do we have in the class?
We're not really totally sure of that. We think there's 400 and something from what we've heard. So our effort is to try and make sure that every senior gets adopted one way or another. If they have friends that can put them on there, or just people who know them just want to go out and adopt them and not even necessarily have to be on there, we just want to make sure that every single senior gets the love.
Okay. And in terms of our Latino community, you've put together a special page in Spanish. Is that how it's working?
We have reached out to the Latino community through Christian Center of Park City and trying to reach all of them that way. Yes, we have changed our announcement at the top and put it in Spanish. That way they can read it and know exactly what the rules are and what we're doing with the group. So that way it's opened up to them also.
All right. So how it works, I mean, what you'll see on this Facebook page, and what is it titled? Park City Senior 2020? Or
it's Adopt a Park City Senior 2020, yes.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So what they do is the parents or grandparents or friends or whatever, they will go on there and post a photo or a whole bunch of photos. We have some people like posting from when they're a baby all the way up to their senior photos. And they just explain a little bit about their senior and what their interests are and what they plan on doing after graduation. And then it pretty much is immediate. As soon as people post on there, we've had people get adopted within the same minute that they're posted.
That's crazy. Yeah. So how do you know if somebody hasn't been adopted? I mean, you'd have to scroll through. I mean, is there a way to kind of search the non-adopted? Or
there
that's not the case?
Search. You can, yeah, you can search in the group and you can search for not adopted. But yeah, pretty much as soon as they get posted, they get changed. So when they're posted, initially it says not adopted on the header. And then once they get adopted, we have them switch it to adopted. That way we know that they have been adopted. Pretty much like I said, as soon as they get posted, they get adopted. We have people posting on there asking for more seniors. They're like ready to adopt them as soon as they post. So.
All right. So spread the word. I mean, if you have a senior or know
Absolutely.
Of a senior, I guess you'd need their permission to be able to post and make sure that that happens. And again, what if the person doing the adopting is a stranger? I mean, how much information do you want to give to somebody?
So what we have suggested is if they don't want to give out their home address or phone number or anything, what they can do is make a private wish list through Amazon of the things that they like or anything and not have to give any personal information. And if the person goes on to their Amazon wish list, it will just send it to their house directly and that person won't have any knowledge of where they live or anything like that. So
that link is kind of embedded then in the post? That wish list link?
For Amazon. It's on Amazon, so they'd have to go on Amazon and make their wish list. But if they set it to private, then it won't be seen by anybody.
Right, right. Okay.
Yeah, so they kind of just have to screen the person. And we, when people join the group, we try to screen them also. We make sure that it's not just Joe Blow from somewhere in California or doesn't even live in Park City. So we specifically make sure that they have friends in the area, and we look into their profile to make sure that they are actually in Park City.
All right. Now, do you and Mike have a senior?
We don't. We have a 10-year-old.
All right. So I was just wondering, I mean, what's kind of been the response then from the seniors?
I think everybody seems really happy. They feel loved, and some of them have posted certain little gifts that they've gotten so far, and they seem to be really enjoying it. It makes them feel special. So,
okay. So is this the Adopted Park City Senior 2020? Is it a public page or somebody would have to kind of join the group?
Yeah, you have to join it. It's a private page. So you have to ask to join and we have to approve them.
Okay.
Yeah, it's Park City Senior 2020 is the Facebook link.
All right. Anything else, Lori, you wanted to mention?
I think that's it. Just spread the word, and we'd like to have every single senior out there get adopted. So if you know a senior, make sure that they're on there somehow.
Okay, what a wonderful effort. Thanks for your time this morning, Lori.
Thank you.
Lori Hampton again with the Park City Senior, Adopt a Park City Senior effort. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:56. Well, following the electronic conventions held last weekend by Utah's Republican and Democratic parties, it turns out that two legislative seats involving Summit County are going to primaries on the GOP side. In one case, though, a candidate just barely missed locking up the nomination. For House District 54, which includes Park City and Wasatch County, two Republican candidates emerged to replace retiring incumbent Tim Quinn. In order to avoid a primary, a candidate has to get over 60% of the vote. In the convention vote, Mike Kohler from Heber City received 59.6% of the delegate count. Randy Favero of Park City received just over 40%. That means they go on to a June 30th primary. The sole Democratic candidate for the seat is Megan Miller. Meanwhile, as we've reported for House District 53, incumbent Logan Wild has withdrawn. The only GOP candidate is another Republican from Morgan County, Kara Birkland. Another Republican has filed from Summit County, France's resident Taladere, but he withdrew. Berkland runs against Democrat Cheryl Butler in November's general election. And concerning State Senate District 19, where incumbent Alan Christensen is retiring, a primary race will take place between Johnny Ferry, who received nearly 55% of the delegate vote, and John Johnson, who received more than 45%. The winner of that primary will go on to face the Democratic candidate, Katie Owens. KPCW News Time now, 8:58. And there will be thunder in the skies Thursday afternoon as fighter jets fly over Utah. Hill Air Force Base announced the flyover will be a salute to everyone on the front lines in the fight against COVID-19. They're also staying at home to flatten the curve of the virus. Four planes will fly in formation starting at 1 in the afternoon. F-35A demo team pilot Captain Kristen Wolf will lead three combat-ready pilots from the 388th Fighter Wing. Wolf said the flyover is a small showcase of appreciation for everyone who's doing their part to combat COVID-19 and also a way to let everyone know who's been affected by the pandemic know that the Air Force stands by them. The flyover is scheduled to take off from the base near Ogden, then proceed south through Salt Lake City down to St. George before looping up to Park City and Logan, then back to the base near Ogden. The commander of the fighter wing says that the flyover also provides essential training for the pilots and demonstrates the readiness of the Air Force. According to the Air Force, the F-35 is known for its stealth qualities that allow it to penetrate airspace that other aircraft cannot and destroy high-threat targets both in the air and on the ground. Again, that flight will start Thursday at 1 in the afternoon. A flight map will be released later this week prior to the flyover. We'll share that on our website, kpcw.org, as soon as it's available. We're up to 50 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Again, looking for mostly sunny skies and a warm one, 72. Overnight low of 47, a high of 72 tomorrow. We've got an increasing chance of a 20% chance of an afternoon shower and thunderstorm. Cooling off a bit, though, by Friday with partly sunny skies and a high of 64. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned now for headline news followed by the Mountain Life. This is KPCW Park City. It's 9 o'clock.